Whoever you are, we welcome you. Wherever you come from, we welcome you. Whomever you love, we welcome you. My name is Reverend Katie Norris, and it's my privilege to serve as consulting minister to this congregation during Reverend Melissa Carvel-Zemer's three-month parental leave. And I'm joined in welcoming you by Camille Pavlicek-Fauser, who is leading our service today.
So, friends, every day, do something. Something that won't compute. Love the Lord. Love the world. Work for nothing. Take all that you have and be poor. Love someone who does not deserve it. Give your approval to all you cannot understand. Be joyful, though you have considered all the facts. Lose your mind and leave it as a sign to mark a false trail, the way you didn't go. Be like a fox who makes more tracks than necessary, some in the wrong direction. Practice resurrection.
Always thought they had a big old set of wings, with flowing robes that never, never, never cling, and played on harps that had at least a dozen strings, and gathered up in groups to sing and sing and sing. But you look like these angels do. Yes, you look like these angels do. And angels look just like you. I always thought that they could fly without a care, stand around in clouds that floated in the air. And if they lost a thing, they always had a spare, for which you must admit is really rather rare. But you look like these angels do. Yes, you look like these angels do. And angels look just like you. I always thought they had a halo on their head, which is so right at night for reading in your bed. I don't believe it, but you know I've heard it said, to be an angel that you first must be dead. But no, you look like these angels do. Yes, you look like these angels do. And angels look just like you. Well, they can join a choir, they can sing a band, or they originate in many different lands. And do not worry, because they always understand that when the music's hot, they always clap their hands. And you look like these angels do. Yes, you look like these angels do. And angels look just like you. Yes, angels look just like you.
It was a warm Saturday during summer, and I had a lot of errands to complete with two school-age sons in tow. As we stepped out of the car in the store parking lot, I noticed walking ahead of me was my youngest son, Matt, who was wearing shorts and one yellow sock and one red sock. His brother, at the age of 6, already recognized that this was in violation of social dress codes and didn't want to be seen walking next to his goofy brother. Of course, some people deliberately defy convention by dressing or behaving differently, but not my son, Matt. He was painfully aware of people looking at him and was clueless as to why they were. Whereas most children learn simple societal customs like wearing matching socks by simply observing others, I had to teach Matt that people wear two socks that look alike. But he'd forget because his mind didn't recognize the social behavior clues that most children absorb automatically while subconsciously modeling their behavior after others. He desperately wanted to fit in and not stand out, but struggled to understand how to achieve this. To help him, I bought him all white socks. This was one of a multitude of adaptations I made as a parent of a child having Asperger's syndrome. We are a people who look toward the future. We plan, we hold expectations. Sometimes we're dealt a hand that we wouldn't have imagined, and we're forced to learn a new strategy. We hope that you find this church community to be a place where you can find fellowship and spiritual support at those times when you need to transform lemons into lemonade. Come, let us worship together.
As we enter into our time of silence this morning, let us contemplate these words of wisdom from our tradition. We receive fragments of holiness, glimpses of eternity, brief moments of insight. Let us gather them up for the precious gifts that they are, and renewed by their grace, move boldly into the unknown. Spirit of life, the light of faith that energizes our lives. We gather here in the midst of winter, when the ground lays dormant, waiting to blossom into new life. When the storms of winter bring beauty and sometimes destruction. Our lives are often the same way. We have tumultuous times when we are tired and need a rest. Yet the storms in our lives often lead into new beginnings, just like the spring. Every one of us has had at least one moment of the unexpected, a moment when all that we had dreamed of and hoped for is lost. If you are in the dark in fear of a storm, May the light of love which surrounds you here be your guide. May you know that you are not alone, and may you reach out to those around you for guidance, support, and comfort. We all have the ability to help another person in some way, through our presence, advice, laughter, and companionship. It is the sunlight of our hearts which sustains those around us through the dark and cold times. May this community be the sunlight and rain which nurtures each other into the spring of our lives. It is in this spirit of care which we pray. Blessed be, and amen.
Amelia Cole Pavlicek-Fauser. I added this name to others on our list of possible names for our baby, our second child who was due to be born at any time. It was April 2nd, 1983, and I revisited our list of names as I prepared an evening supper for my husband and me, mindful of the reality that quiet suppers with one child already tucked in bed would soon be set aside for diaper washings and midnight nursings. It had been 6.5 years since Jeff and I had experienced the happy chaos of a new baby, and we were ready for number 2. My pregnancy had been uncomplicated. I had managed to dampen a few recurring fears as being baseless. I had no particular fears to identify except an intuitive sense that all wasn't as it should be. I tend to be an anxious person, so I kept these thoughts to myself. Besides, could I really remember how I felt being pregnant 6.5 years earlier? Pregnant, pregnancy, fecund, fullness, life-giving. For some women, becoming pregnant seemed easy. I marveled at this. How some couples could go away for a romantic weekend to get pregnant. How could that be? Not so easy for my husband and me. Yet here we were on April 2nd, Easter Saturday, our supper done, baby names decided, hospital bag packed, and care providers on call for our son Rio. As if pleased with the name we had finally chosen for her, names of two of her great-grandmothers, my labor began that night, and Amelia was born at 5:15 on Easter Sunday morning. Our joy and elation was soon followed by concern as hospital staff began to notice problems. Emmy was whisked away for a quick x-ray that was anything but quick. Minute followed miserable minute as we waited for information on our baby. We continued to tell ourselves that it's probably nothing serious. However, this hope quickly faded as we were informed that Emmy had dislocated hips, rocker bottom feet, and contractures of the hands and arms. Emmy was experiencing periods of apnea, at which time she would quickly turn a dusky blue. The doctors who initially examined Emmy believed that she might also have a rare chromosomal abnormality and thus might only live for a short time. We were urged to have Emmy transported to Akron Children's Hospital's neonatal intensive care unit, but I could hardly imagine our daughter going off to another location without us, especially when we wondered if she had much time to live. Jeff and I finally agreed to the transport, knowing that Emmy's pediatrician and a geneticist would meet her at Akron Children's for a thorough examination and consultation with other specialists. No amount of planning, not the lists, the books, the childbirth preparation classes, can prepare you for a day like this. Our expectations of an uncomplicated birth in a suite, followed by a short stay in the hospital, the challenges of infancy and toddlerhood, sibling spats, years of schooling, sports, music lessons, university, friends, loves, all seemed to evaporate as we wondered if our baby would survive her myriad problems. How could we possibly convey all this news to family and friends who were waiting to delight in the birth of our baby? That is to say, our baby who was to be born healthy and without complications. What about our son who was staying with friends and excited about having a sibling? Alone in our worry and sorrow, my husband and I questioned everything. What had we done wrong? Was God in the universe exacting some payment for past wrongs? My brother had been killed in the Vietnam War. Wasn't that payment enough? Why was God doing this to our little baby, to our family? In her book, Laura's Mom Learns, the late Ruth Smith wrote, "As enlightened as I pretend to be, I fall prey to the awful quagmire of guilty thoughts regarding my daughter. I've asked myself over and over, did I eat something or drink something during my pregnancy that could have caused this? What did I do?" Oh, the crippling effect of combining emotions and unanswered questions. Although the geneticist confirmed that our daughter did not have a life-threatening genetic condition after all, our family was still left with many questions, very few answers, and a baby who was struggling to survive. Why?
This is an excerpt from Spanish writer José Ortega y Gasset. The man with the clear head is the man who frees himself from fantasy and looks life in the face, realizes that everything in it is problematic, and feels himself lost. And this is the simple truth that to live is to feel oneself lost. Whoever accepts this has already begun to find himself to be on firm ground. Instinctively, as do the shipwrecked, he will look around for something to which to cling. And that tragic, ruthless glance, absolutely sincere, because it is a question of his salvation, will cause him to bring order to the chaos of his life. These are the only genuine ideas, the ideas of the shipwrecked. All the rest is rhetoric, posturing, farce. He who does not really find himself lost is without remission. That is to say, he never finds himself, never comes up against his own reality.
Coming up against one's own reality can be a shocker. Bearing witness to the truth of one's situation can take a lifetime. How do we resurrect ourselves when we feel lost and without hope? I was shipwrecked and adrift, bargaining with and feeling abandoned by a God I seemed to feel directed my life from some throne in the sky, full of questions with no clear answers. Emmy spent the first month of her life in the hospital, the biggest kid on the unit because she had been full term, however, probably one of the most fragile in terms of her brain's ability to direct her respiration. We stumbled through the first months of Emmy's life, knowing that she was severely disabled with a diagnosis that described so much that it said very little. Our lives were scheduled around doctor's appointments, therapies, and ultimately hip and eye surgeries. None of the medical specialists could give us the answers we craved. We grabbed for life rafts, hoping for any information that would give us the assurance that our daughter would outgrow her diagnosis and be another typically developing girl. I look back on those days and realize how much of my energy was spent on seeking a reason for Emmy's disability. I suppose that I still do at times, but somewhere along the way, I learned that I no longer seemed to mind the uncertainty. The large part of me that is reasonable and organized demands to know the whys and wherefores. It was and can be nearly gut-wrenching to give up that quest for answers, to let go and float adrift. One book that gave me such strength was Harold Kushner's When Bad Things Happen to Good People. Rabbi Kushner stated, in the final analysis, the question of why bad things happen to good people translates itself into some very different questions. No longer asking why something happened, but asking how we will respond, what we intend to do now that it has happened. Just what was I going to do now? Would Emmy's Easter birth guide our family to learn and grow, to resurrect ourselves from what seemed so hopeless? Putting one foot in front of the other and making it through the day was the first order of business. That focus on the moment can be very difficult for me. Paraphrasing Wendell Berry, I had to give my approval to all I could not understand. I'd love to tell you that my resurrection, my rebirth, came in a moment of inspiration and enlightenment, but that is not so. My resurrection came and is coming, born again and again in fits and starts, only through practice, practice, practice. And what about that God who seemed nowhere to be found? As I reflect on this time, I ponder the many ways I felt about God, believed in, disbelieved in, argued with, hated, challenged, and felt abandoned by. I recently read a piece about how Americans imagine God. I think that every imagining expressed in that piece was at one time a vision held by me. One quote from a pastor, Kenny Rawls, stated that he imagines God sitting on a throne lofty and exalted. Carla Layden from New York City sees God as a great loving father who lets me climb into his lap. Yes, I think I could have once described God in those ways. The descriptions were varied, however, one particularly resonated with me. It was Rabbi David Volpe's, in which he stated that God is something I cannot begin to imagine. Is God the ground of my being, as Paul Tillich describes? I'm just not sure. But somewhere in all this birthing and rebirthing, the questions remain, but the needs for answers just didn't seem to matter as much. Oddly enough, that time of uncertainty seemed just the time when I would feel grounded and most alive to the possibilities of life and what life had to offer Emmy and to our family. Rabbi Kushner commented that Job asked questions about God, but he did not need lessons in theology. He needed sympathy and compassion and the reassurance that he was a good person and a cherished friend. I love our congregation's description of itself as a beloved community. Job needed a beloved community, and it was just this sort of community that bore us up and helped us through many difficult times. Early on, after Emmy was born, I often winced at the well-meaning comments by others. It takes a special person to raise a child with disabilities. Nothing special about me, thought I, just a very tired mom trying to get through the day. God never gives us more than we can handle. Oh, yeah. More than anything, I love the support that we received from those who weren't afraid to bumble along with us. For example, the friend who said, "Just give me something to do for you so I won't have to worry so much." Those who picked up our son from kindergarten and took him home for play dates and overnight stays. Emmy's godmother, who spent countless hours in the medical school library doing research for us before the internet. And a very special memory of coming home from the hospital after an especially challenging day with Emmy, feeling hungry and not knowing what we would eat for dinner, opening the door to our home and smelling a delicious aroma. As Jeff and I walked into our kitchen, there was a pot of turkey soup simmering on the stove. The memory comforts me to this day. Our precious neighbor had known we would be hungry and had let herself in to do what needed to be done. Of course, this story implies that in order to help, you need to have the keys to your neighbor's house. I learned that in reality, we do have those keys. I have learned that we all have a story to tell. Sometimes the most mundane tasks can turn out to be huge events, huge in the symbolic sense, that is. About 10 or so years ago, I opened a savings account for Emmy. The branch manager led me through all the paperwork, and as we came to the close of the meeting, she informed me that I would need to have Emmy sign a signature card. I informed the manager that this wouldn't be possible due to Emmy's inability to sign her name, and I gave a very brief description of the severity of Emmy's mental retardation. This woman looked on me with an expression of pity and stated, "Some of us just don't realize how lucky we are." Lucky? What does luck have to do with this? I could feel my muscles tense, my face probably flushed. I felt diminished. I was ready to hurl a fiery retort, move in for the kill, or worse. What happened next surprised me most of all. Seldom have I experienced grace, that unbidden gift, that amazing surprise in such a tangible way. Well, I can tell you that grace descended upon me, and instead of the fiery retort, I took a deep breath and responded, "You know, we all have a story to tell." As a moment passed, and I watched this woman's face change from an expression of pity to one of self-realization, her eyes welled as she said, "You know, you're right. My life hasn't been easy. I raised my two sons as a single mom." Her husband's drug addiction nearly destroyed their family, and she struggled mightily to raise her boys to manhood. This moment is so vivid, so precious. Our interaction, especially my possible response, could have ended dreadfully. As it was, this woman and I felt a special bond. Each of us does have a story to tell. We are bound by stories which vary greatly, but connect us in ways that can be mysterious and grace-filled. The writer Michael Bartel, who lives with Tourette syndrome, expressed this connectedness in another way when he wrote, "Besides, when you really get to know other people, your friends, your family, your partner, you realize we're all pretty weird." Emmy has taught me that we must be open to others and to life as it is, not some fantasy of what life should be. Ruth Smith wrote, "My beautiful daughter loves the life she has and lives without regrets or guilt or self-questioning. It is my daughter who also gives me the strength to haltingly follow her example and trust that the world will always be as beautiful to her as she believes it to be." These are lovely yet terrifying words when you listen to them carefully. Emmy has taught me that the world is beautiful, that the time is now. However, she has few fears and most likely believes that everyone loves her. I remain fearful for her and often reluctant to share her joy and enthusiasm, but perhaps this is the way to embrace life. I can't help but wonder if we truly believed that everyone loved us, that we would deserve to be loved for our very own selves. Could we then be better lovers of others, better stewards to each other and to the intricate web of all existence? I have learned that there are many forms of communication. Speech is just one of them. Emmy has a boyfriend. Emmy and this man are in the same sheltered work group at Portage Industries. A social, engaging woman, Emmy has a very limited vocabulary, and many of her words are recognizable only to those of us who know her well. Nonetheless, she is very verbal and can usually get her point across with a variety of vocalizations. Emmy's boyfriend has almost no apparent expressive verbal abilities, and his receptive verbal skills are limited. However, Emmy and this fellow communicate volumes. They enjoy each other's company, and Emmy has chosen him over others in her group who are far more vocal and demonstrative. I cannot see that this fellow delights in Emmy's company as she does in his. However, I've got to trust her judgment on this. She can see and hear what I cannot. They care for one another in ways that I cannot fathom. But the lesson isn't lost on me. How can I hear the message from another even when I don't understand his or her language? How can I challenge myself to believe that there are dimensions of communication of which I am not aware? Life lessons. These lessons continue, are reborn to me daily. And new lessons are there if only I can be open enough to learn them. In her book, A Difference in the Family, Helen Featherstone writes that all members of a family are immensely vulnerable to one another. The pain of one child's disability reshapes every life in unexpected ways. Nonetheless, individuals endure. Each makes a life, often a good one, out of a difference in the family. Our lives were reshaped by Emmy's birth and her disability. In addition to Emmy's older brother, Rio, our family grew by one when John was born in 1985, a typically developing boy. Yes, we are immensely vulnerable to one another's uniqueness, but we have also come alive in one another. Borrowing from the words of Kathleen Norris, "Rebirth is no more spectacular than learning to love the people we live with and work among. It does not mean seeking out the most exotic spiritual experience or the ideal religion or the holiest teachers who will give us the greatest return on our investment. Rebirth is seeing ourselves and the ordinary people in our families, our classrooms, and on the job in a new light. Can it be that these very people, even the difficult ones, are the ones God has given us so that together we might find salvation? Let us take our periods of darkness and see them in a new light. Let us practice resurrection. Blessed be and amen."
A few times a month, we give our collection to an organization that aligns with our values. This week, we'll be giving our collection to Urban Hope, a Unitarian Universalist spiritual community serving the inner city of Cleveland. Urban Hope is a lay-led community who survives on the generous donations of churches like this one. They seek to serve the local community in quite a few ways, including worship each Sunday afternoon, a drop-in center every week, and a community meal once a month. During the growing season, Urban Hope maintains a vegetable garden plot at the Kentucky School Community Garden and uses it to instruct children in gardening techniques and philosophy, and the products of the garden are given to the children. I've had the opportunity to help out at Urban Hope on a couple Sundays, and I've seen the good work that they are doing in the community. Many of the participants at Urban Hope are homeless or severely underserved by our community. At Urban Hope, they find spiritual reflection, community resources, warmth, and a group of people who cares for one another in any way that they know how. They seek to live out the Unitarian Universalist principle that everyone has inherent worth and dignity, and everyone is loved just as they are. Please give generously and within your means this morning, and thank you for supporting this much-needed Unitarian Universalist community. Just a reminder to please use the pew envelope, which is found in the holder on the back of the pew in front of you, for your donations, and indicate on that envelope if your offering is for your regular offering, which would be your pledge, by checking the regular offering box, or the special offering by checking the special offering box in the envelope. You can make all the checks out to the UU Church of Kent and write Urban Hope in the memo line if it's for the special collection. Again, thank you very much for your donations, and this morning's offering will now be gratefully given and received.
It's in every one of us to be wise. Find your heart, open up both your eyes. We can all know everything without ever knowing why. It's in every one of us by and by. It's in every one of us. I just remembered, it's like I've been sleeping for years. I'm not awake as I can be, but I see it's better. It can see through the tears. I've been realizing that I bought the ticket and watching only half of the show. But there's scenery and lights and a cast of thousands who all know what I know, and it's good that it's so. It's in every one of us to be wise. Find your heart, open up both your eyes. We can all know everything without ever knowing why. It's in every one of us by